Welcome back, everybody, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, and we have another very special episode today. Instead of looking at the X-Files as we normally do, either the new series or the older episodes, we have another exclusive interview. And I'm very delighted to announce that today we have joining us author Keith R.A. DeCandido. Hello, Keith.
Hello, Tony.
Have I pronounced your name right there?
You did actually pronounce my name right, which is remarkable because usually people get it wrong. I have spent my entire life correcting the mispronunciation of my last name, and I did not have to do that today, and I thank you for that.
You're very welcome. I'm very glad that I've done it right. Yes, well, thank you for coming on the X-Cast, Keith, to talk about your body of work, buddy, but primarily your contribution to the X-Files anthology book, Trust No One, which is a great short story that you contributed to that. So we're going to talk a little bit about that and about your, as I say, your career. But before then, I'd like to ask you what we call the five questions of X, just to get, not cheesy at all, just to get a an idea of your X-Files fandom. So the first question I will ask you then is, when did you first discover the X-Files?
Right when it first started, I watched it pretty much from jump when it first started airing. You know, I'm a huge science fiction fan, have been pretty much since birth, and I was interested enough to check the show out, and I got hooked on it pretty quickly.
Awesome. So you were there at the very beginning in 1993, basically.
Yep, and stuck with it mostly to the end.
Did you tune out just before?
Yeah, the last couple seasons, I really kind of lost track of it and didn't really feel motivated to keep up. I just thought it was kind of floundering at that point.
I think a lot, even the diehard fans, I think, would agree with you in most part there. Okay, well, if that's when you discovered the X-Files, my next question is, what is your favorite episode of the X-Files, if you have one?
Oh, boy. Probably... I'm blanking on titles. I used to have all the titles completely memorized, but I'm much older now, and there's a lot more information in my head. It would have to be probably a tie between two very different episodes. The one with Brad Dourif, I think it was Beyond the Sea.
That's right, yeah.
Because it was just such a nice inversion of the usual Scully-Mulder dynamic. Mm. Plus, it made use not only of Brad Dourif, who's one of my favorite actors, but also Don Davis, who played Scully's dad, or the ghost of Scully's dad. That, and also the... the one at the carnival.
Oh, Humbug, the comedy one.
Humbug, yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Humbug was just brilliant on every possible level, I thought. As much as I love Darren Morgan, I don't think he's ever quite topped. Everything he's done since Humbug has been an attempt to recapture the magic of Humbug. It hasn't quite made it, but still, it's that I thought was just a wonderful episode on so many levels.
Just as a sidebar question, have you seen any of the new season yet with his new episode? Have you enjoyed any of it yet?
His favorite of the four I've seen so far. I absolutely loved that. It wasn't quite perfect. It was a little clumsy. The final third of it or so was a little too much people standing around and talking. Mm. But even with that, I thought it was really well put together.
It was nice to see a Darren Morgan comedy back, I think, definitely. Yeah.
No, I like the new series has been like hitting all the high points of, you know.
Well, I was just about to say, have you been enjoying the new run so far?
Yeah, no, I have been. As with the original, I'm much more interested in the more basic them solving weird crime thing than the vast alien conspiracy thing, which never really gripped me at all, and I didn't think was very well handled. I was much more interested in them as the two people who solve the weird crimes than them against the world. Against the evil conspiracy that rules the world, because I've never had much patience with conspiracy stories anyway. Because, not to put too fine a point on it, but people aren't that organized, and I just that particular plot line, despite the fact that some of the best moments involved William B. Davis's cigarette smoking man, and particularly also John Neville, his character. Despite that, I just, you know. It just didn't work for me, but I love the weird cases. That was what really drew me in.
Well, I think with the benefit of hindsight and the test of time, I think most people now look back at the original seasons and think, well, a lot of the standalones are the best episodes, and they stand the test of time a bit more, don't they?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Well, thinking back to previous seasons, my next question is: what would you say your favorite season of the X-Files is overall?
Probably the second. Which is part of why I set my story interest no one during the second season, at least partly because that was the one I enjoyed the most. The way they wrote Gillian Anderson out to accommodate her pregnancy has got to be something that had never been done in television before and probably hasn't been done since, is basically abducted, you know, in a series in which alien abduction is a part of the texture of it, to have one of the main characters actually be abducted. Also, I couldn't help but laugh hysterically when we have the shot of her after she was abducted and they're expanding her stomach when
it's cleverly done.
But I thought that was, in general, I thought the show really had hit its stride in the second season. They started to realize what gold they had in Mitch Pileggi's Skinner character. And I thought just everything just cohered really well. And just there were some really, really strong episodes that year.
I would completely agree with you there. And it's interesting to hear you say that. It makes a lot of sense thinking about the story you've written for Trust No One, because there is certainly some key ties to season two. And we'll obviously get to that later on when we talk about that. But that doesn't surprise me. You've said that. And I do agree. For my next question then, simply, who is your favourite character on The X-Files? Now, this doesn't have to obviously just be Mulder and Scully. It could be any one of the guest characters or supporting characters or anybody.
Honestly, it would be Dana Scully, just because I thought she was, and still think she's a character that we don't see nearly often enough. I mean, the 90s were kind of a golden era for strong female characters on television. You know, you had your Buffys, you had your Xenas, you had your Aaron Sons, you had your Susan Ivanovas, you had your Kira Nerises, your Jadzia Daxes. But Scully was different. You know, she wasn't really so much of a kick-ass female character in the physical sense, but more in the mental sense. And there was nothing about her character. No, that's not, I'm phrasing this badly. But she was just a very intelligent, interesting character. She was allowed to have a certain complexity, and she was just, you know, she wore sensible shoes. She didn't go running around in heels. and she was a doctor. You know, it was just, I liked that character. I liked, and I particularly liked the way Gillian Anderson played her, because she is an incredibly subtle actor. She's somebody who obviously, whose acting style is perfect for television, because, you know, movies tend to be, you know, big theater. You have to exaggerate. On television, subtlety is because it's television is a much more intimate medium than movies or theater, that it rewards that the kind of subtle acting that she does. And she is superb at it. She can do so much with a simple facial expression or a slight upturn of the lip or, you know, her eyes. And, you know, it was just a perfect combination of actor and character.
So. Yeah, definitely. I think you're absolutely right. It's been interesting to hear some of the conversations about Gillian Anderson playing Scully now, in that she seems to play her a bit differently, or her voice has changed and things like that. But I think quite some of the criticisms have been unfair actually lately, in that, you know, Scully has aged, you know, Gillian Anderson has aged, and I think she's still playing the character really well even now, as is David Duchovny with Mulder.
Well, one of the things I like about the new series is that they are older, and they're really embracing that. They're not trying to just have it be, you know, we're doing the same thing we were doing 20 years ago. The passage of time has been a very important subtext in the show, and that shows in how both of them play it.
Definitely, yeah. The final question for me with these questions is, what would you say your favourite moment of The X-Files has been over the years? If there's a scene or a particular, you know, piece of it you remember, is there anything that stands out to you as just a moment you love from the show?
Actually, yes, and it's a scare moment.
Oh, okay.
Actually, it's the this is where you pucker up and kiss my ass scene.
Oh yeah.
Partly because I thought that his solution to, what, you know, the information on the digital tape by passing it on to the Navajo was brilliant. I actually hadn't known much about Navajo code talkers until they mentioned it in the X-Files, and I actually did a little research and actually and also discovered that they got a few things wrong, but, you know, dramatic wastes. But even so, that was an aspect of World War II history I wasn't really familiar with, and I was really I enjoyed that, and I thought that was a great use of it. And that whole scene, that was just beautifully done. And it really solidified Skinner as a powerful character in his own right. You know, I mean, he started out as just, you know, yet another bureaucrat in Mulder and Scully's way. And I love the way the character evolved. Mitch Pileggi is one of my favorite actors.
Yeah, he's great, isn't he?
He really brings an intensity to all of his roles, and that role in particular was just fantastic.
Yeah, it was a wonderful moment. In fact, you're not the first person to answer with that when I've asked these questions. Yeah, somebody else said the same thing the moment where Skinner confronts the Smoking Man. It's a great moment, yeah. It's a great moment for him. So
I had all the episodes on VHS tape, or at least the first four or five seasons or so. And I replayed that. I wore the tape down on that scene. I just, you know, I love that scene so much.
It was a really good trilogy of episodes, actually, the Anasazi trilogy, season two, season three, yeah. That's brilliant. Thank you for that. That's given us a good overview of your X-Files fandom. So
I didn't even mention the biggest part of my X-Files fandom, which is that I actually helped run a couple of very small X-Files conventions.
Oh, awesome. When was that?
In New Jersey, here in the States. Mm-hmm. Me and my friend Laura Ann Gilman and a bunch of other friends of ours. Laura Ann's also an author. She's written the Rich River series and is currently doing the Devil's West series. Fantasy novels. She and I were both huge fans of the show, and we actually put together a very small, like 100 person relaxicon called The File Cabinet.
Awesome.
We did two of them in the mid 90s, and it was, you know, little. I think it was in Morristown, New Jersey. We did both of them, and it was just, you know, a lot of fun hanging out, just, you know, talking the X-Files and screening episodes and such. You know, we enjoyed that. That's there is nothing else I have been actually interested in running a convention for.
Really?
Attending a convention, sure, you know, but the X-Files fandom was sufficiently deep that I actually did that. So.
And that was at the peak of it, wasn't it? You know, mid-90s. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was like 95, 96, I think, is when we did
that. Yeah, that must have been really good. That's awesome. That's really good. I didn't know that. Fantastic. So yeah, you're one of the gate masters for X-Files fandom then from the old days.
back on the old genie computer bulletin board, back when we thought, you know, 9600 baud was fast. Our little, you know, monochrome monitors watching the text scroll by slowly talking about the X-Files.
Those were the days. Let's talk a little bit more about your contribution to X-Files literature then, because obviously, as we said, you contributed to the Trust No One anthology that came out last year. Yeah. And we're on the verge of the follow-up anthology coming out, The Truth Is Out, which is out this week. And we spoke to Greg Cox, who wrote one of those stories last week about that, and that was great. So how did you end up becoming one of the authors in this anthology? How did this come to you?
Fairly simply, I've done a lot of work with Jonathan Mayberry in the past. You know, he and I are part of a sort of writers collective called the Liars Club, which is a group of writers who do a lot of literacy and outreach things and other stuff. And we'd worked together before. I've worked with Jonathan on his V-Wars series, which is a world vampire series, which is also with IDW, and a couple other things here and there. So I was one of the people he went to for that. So it was just, you know, a case of already being familiar with the editor and him. And Jonathan's a big fan of my writing. He always has been, and I have his. And so he invited me to pitch something. So so I did. It was as simple as that. So yeah, I jumped at it because as we've established, I have a certain affection for the X-Files. So.
Well, that's great. Back in El Paso, My Life Will Be Worthless is the name of your story. Yeah, it's a really good name for it. It's a great tale. I really, really enjoy. I've enjoyed all the stories in that anthology, but I really enjoyed this one for many different reasons. Where did the idea for that particular story originate?
There were a series of unsolved murders in. They weren't in El Paso, actually. They were in Mexico, not far from El Paso. But because there's the FBI, I had to, you know, replant it to be within the States. That was just, and I, very little of that original remained. I was just looking for, you know, unsolved serial killer cases that I might riff off of. So that was sort of the impetus for that part of the plot. The actual story itself, the main inspiration for the story, and the thing that I particularly wanted to do, was I wanted to show Mulder and Scully from the point of view of a normal FBI agent.
Yeah.
We almost never saw a regular FBI agent on the X-Files. You know, Krycek turned out to be a double agent, and everybody else were just, you know, other people in the office, you know? And so on, you know, other characters brought in, but they became sucked into the whole X-Files thing.
Yeah.
I wanted to show just, you know, regular old federal agent just doing his job, and how that person would view the two weirdos in the basement.
It's interesting because obviously that character is Jack Colt, who is your creation.
I wanted to give him, I wanted to make him sound like, you know, a manly G-man, you know, Jack Colt.
Yeah, he sounds like a proper old lawman. I thought that when I was, yeah. And obviously the story's told from his point of view.
That was incredibly deliberate, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And it's because it's interesting, obviously, you say about, you know, how you wanted it to be from the, you know, from the view of an FBI, a traditional FBI agent. Because when we did see, like you said, when we did see people who weren't, you know, like Mulder and Scully, they were either double agents or they were quite often just unsympathetic idiots. Whereas Jack Colt actually is a really interesting character because he's very real. You know, he reacts in a way I think that a lot of, you know, traditional people would act. So was that the key inspiration? Was that what you wanted to get across?
Pretty much, yeah. That was what I was going for, was just, you know, having somebody, you know, not part of the grand conspiracy, not sucked into Mulder's orbit as, you know, somebody who believes in the weird stuff, and then getting sucked into it, obviously, because otherwise it wouldn't be an X-Files story. But
yeah.
I also kind of like the idea, because this is, you know, that there's, I kind of hinted at it at the end, that there's this sort of underground community of monsters and weirdos and stuff who are really worried about Mulder and Scully.
Yeah.
Because they're getting close, and it's like, damn, these guys know what they're doing. Crap.
but even then, with Jack Colt, it never feels like he completely becomes, you know, a true believer. He, at the end, is reluctantly turning around and going, well, I can't, there's no other explanation for what's going on. I'm in trouble now. Maybe they're right. But even at the end, he's still saying, you know, he still can't quite bring himself to believe. And I thought that was very real as well.
Thank you.
But just going back to the title quickly, where did the inspiration for the actual title come from?
That's from an old country music song.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a Marty Robbins song, just called El Paso. The refrain goes, back in El Paso, my life would be worthless. So, yeah.
Oh, excellent. Okay, that's my limited knowledge of country music coming out there. But I'm sure plenty of people got that. So obviously, you talked briefly about the monster then, but the Native American skin changer is effectively your monster, although I felt you left it fairly ambiguous at the end a little bit. You know, Mulder puts the theory out there, but you never know necessarily 100%. And because it's obviously from Colt's point of view as well. So how did you come behind this kind of monster and the folklore behind it?
Oh, that was just doing, you know, research into that sort of thing. And they covered it at least a little bit with other types of, you know, most of the skinwalkers that of legend can turn into animals. And we saw one in one episode of The X-Files, and I referenced that in the story. But
yeah.
I was just pulling from existing lore and extrapolating it to, you know, like Mulder said, it's not that much of a stretch to go to turn into a different type of animal. Since the legends of skinwalkers came from a time when most people believed that, you know, humans and animals had nothing to do with, were completely different from each other, whereas, you know, evolutionary theory show that there's a lot more relationships among them, among humans and animals, than you know, most people would have believed prior to the 19th century or so. You know, the idea that a skinwalker could also turn into a different type of human makes perfect sense from a biological perspective. So let's do that. But it was just basically taking existing folklore and putting an X-Files twist on it.
And it has a quite a chilling ending as well. You know, one of those classic sort of X-Files endings that, you know, leaves everything a little bit ambiguous out there and leaves someone, you know, it reminded me almost of, I don't know if you're familiar with the episode Grotesque, which had Kurtwood Smith playing an FBI agent, and it ends very badly for him, and we've discussed this on the X-Cast previously, and it reminded me a little bit of that a whatever force, whatever monster has left somebody who's innocent in trouble. So that was really good. If you were commissioned to write any more X-Files short stories or even a full-length novel, do you have any ideas in mind about what you might do, or do you have any backup stories that you?
Oh, sure. I love doing stuff with existing folklore. And actually, you know, I have some. I've written also for Supernatural, which I've written three Supernatural novels, and I have a couple of urban fantasy things that I do. One taking place in Key West, one I'm working on right now that takes place in New York City, where I'm from. And I love digging around into bits of folklore and playing with them and doing twists on them and using them for fantasy stories. You know, I've got a bunch of stories where, you know, a bunch of Norse gods are hanging out in Key West, stuff like that. So that same mindset is what I, you know, would bring to another X-Files story if I got the opportunity to do one. I actually pitched an X-Files novel back in the late 90s.
Oh, really?
It was weird. HarperCollins was sort of doing kind of an open call where they were basically looking for, you know, experienced science fiction writers to pitch novels. My career was only just starting at the time, but I'd had a few short stories out and a novel out, and so I pitched. But the you could only send one pitch.
Right.
And if Chris Carter didn't like it, then you couldn't send another pitch, and apparently he didn't like mine. So
that's a shame.
I don't even remember what it was now, to be perfectly honest, because we're talking like all, you know, 15, 20 years ago. But there's all sorts of possibilities. You know, if I think, you know, there's all sorts of folklore out there, all sorts of legends. I mean, the show covered a lot of them, but there's still plenty more out there that they didn't touch on. And I love that sort of thing. One thing I would probably want to approach I would take with an X-Files novel would be very similar to the approach I took with Supernatural, because both Supernatural and the X-Files have a similar issue, which is that they travel all over the country, but everywhere they go looks just like Vancouver.
It's true, very true.
Both Supernatural and the X-Files have a lot of travel involved, but they are really unable to embrace their location to any great degree. It is not a coincidence that my three Supernatural novels all took place in cities with very distinctive characters. My first one was actually also in New York, specifically in the Bronx. My second one was in Key West, Florida, and the third one was in San Francisco. All of those are cities that have a very distinctive feel to them. And that's the sort of thing I would want to do with the X-Files, too, is have them go somewhere. You know, basically, the best thing that tie-in fiction can do is do something that the source material can't.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. And in the case of that's, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I specifically did something that was from the POV of a regular FBI agent. That kind of sharp internal point of view is something that prose can do that no other storytelling medium can. And this was an opportunity to do something, you know, that hadn't been done, that you know, and that prose was in a much more unique position to do, because, you know, the camera is pretty much omniscient, you know, so you can filter in the short story, you can filter everything through one particular character's head, which gives you a different perspective. So that's the kind of approach I would take. You know, which particular bit of folklore I would do would depend on what I was researching that day, you know? or what, you know, what location I went with. I mean, one of the reasons why I went with El Paso is just because I've never set a story there. I've also never been there, and that presented its own set of challenges. Although it's interesting. I have seen two reviews from people who are from El Paso, or at least who have been there, and one said I got it perfectly right, and one said I got it completely wrong. So
who knows? You're probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, I did as much. Thank Christ for the internet is all I have to say. I looked up everything I could. I dug around. I looked at lots of pictures, video, and such to make sure I got the feel. I mean, one person I was particularly glad. She said I absolutely nailed what a sunrise looks like in El Paso, which was one of the things I was, you know, I looked at a lot of pictures, you know, and tried to. It's hard, you know, if you've never actually been to a place, and that was one of the things I was concerned about with doing a story in a location I hadn't been to, because I'm from New York and I love my city, and I can sometimes tell when somebody's research of New York is done entirely with Google Maps. they got the details are right, but the feel is wrong. And I was I was genuinely worried about that with El Paso, but at least one native thinks I got it right. So, yeah.
That would mean that, yeah, there were people that probably more than obviously that one person thought that. So that's really good. Well, I do hope you know, you get another shot at telling another X-Files story. Tracking back a little bit, though, just going back to you and you as a writer, what was it that made you want to do this? What made you want to become a writer? And
I don't know. I've never not wanted to write. I couldn't tell you. That desire has always been there. The first thing I wrote was a little book I made on construction paper called Reflections in My Mirror when I was 6.
Wow.
I have it, actually.
Cool.
But I don't know, but I've always wanted to make stories. That's just something that's always been there. You know, I have no idea where it comes from. It's just, and you know, I've been, my parents read to me from when I was a little kid. You know, as soon as I was old enough to read, I was doing things like, I was reading, you know, Heinlein's Juveniles, Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea Trilogy, and The Hobbit, you know?
Yeah.
That was my formative reading experiences once I started, you know, once I got past picture books, basically. So, you know, that the desire to write's always been there, and the love of science fiction has always been there. You know, I was reading that stuff. I was watching Star Trek pretty much from birth.
Yeah.
So yeah, that just, you know, writing science fiction was almost inevitable.
Well, what advice would you give new writers or people who are just starting out now in a very different, obviously, landscape? What, as someone who's been doing this for a long time, what would you say to new writers?
Same path. Landscape has nothing to do with the most important advice, which is to actually finish what you start.
Mm.
What separates writers from wannabes is the ability to finish your work. The ratio of stories that have been started, particularly novels that have been started, to novels that have been finished is about 80 bajillion to one. it's a lot easier to start something than finish it. Mm. And finishing it is what makes the difference. And far too many people get caught up in wanting to make the beginning so perfect that they never actually make it to the end. Mm. And the secret is the first draft is always going to suck. Resign yourself to that. But it's much easier to revise a finished, fix and revise and improve a finished story than it is a fragment. So the best piece of advice, really, that I always give is to just get through, barrel through to the end. It doesn't have to be perfect the first time. It's not going to be perfect the first time. Just get through it, and then you have a completed story. And that's a much more valuable thing than a couple of pages or a couple of chapters or whatever.
It's good advice, definitely. I think a lot of young writers especially struggle with that one. So yeah,
old ones too, but
yeah. Obviously, you've written for dozens of other established universities.
More than 25, I think, at this point. So.
Wow, but primarily Star Trek, though. Do you have a particular favorite? I'm sure you enjoy writing all of them, but do you have a particular favorite that you've written in or you continue to write in?
It's hard to narrow it down. Star Trek is obviously a big one because A, I've done so much in it,
mm.
And B, that fandom, as I said, goes back to birth. Earlier, if my mother's to be believed, because I was born in 1969 when the third season was still airing.
Yeah.
So Star Trek would definitely be a big one.
Mm.
Also, Farscape, partly because I was a big fan of it, partly because of what I got to do in Farscape. I wrote one novel in 2001, and then from 2008 to 2011, I worked with Rockne O'Bannon, the show's creator, create a bunch of basically fifth season comic books that we did for Boom Studios.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which was one of my absolute best writing experiences of any kind. Was doing those comics.
Mm.
That was great. So those two probably, but I mean, there's so many things I've enjoyed that I've gotten to write in. I'm doing a Marvel Comics based trilogy, and I've been a Marvel fan also practically since birth. a trilogy called Marvel's Tales of Asgard, which has features Thor and Sif and the Warriors 3.
Oh, cool.
My first novel and my first short story were both Spider-Man short story, and then later a Spider-Man novel. So getting to do that was also fun too. It's interesting because like some of the ones I've come to, it's like I've wanted to do it. Like Farscape, I was like Donkey and Shrek jumping up and down saying, "Pick me, pick me." I was like that with Farscape. I was like that with Leverage.
Mm.
I did a Leverage novel and some others. And then there are others where they came to me, like World of Warcraft. I really wasn't familiar with, but the editors at Simon & Schuster said, "Hey, would you like to? We think you'd be good to write a World of Warcraft novel." Or I did a novel based on Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda, the Kevin Sorbo show from the 2000s. And I had like watched two or three episodes maybe, but then in those cases where it's something I wasn't a fan of already, I then went into research mode. My parents are librarians, and which is one of the reasons why I got all those cool books to read when I was a kid. And I love doing research. You know, that was part of the fun of doing the X-Files story, was doing the research into the skinwalkers and into old serial killer cases. And with Andromeda and with World of Warcraft and then later StarCraft, I dove into it to learn everything I could about it and mainline it, and then I became a fan of it, you know.
Yeah.
So I tend to try to find the joy in it where at all possible.
Well, I mean, the joy must be being able to do this for a living, you know, and be able to write in these universes. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. Well, speaking of, you mentioned a couple of other things you're doing. Tell us then about some of your upcoming or newly released work. Like you recently had a tie-in Heroes Reborn novel out, didn't you?
Yeah, a novella, really. Bastet put out six novellas that tied into Heroes Reborn, basically filling in backstory on various elements of the miniseries that the miniseries itself wasn't able to cover. Mine was called Save the Cheerleader, Destroy the World, which basically filled in what the character of Claire Bennett was doing between the end of the original Heroes which ended with her basically going public with her powers. That was the last scene in the last episode of Heroes was her going public. And then we pick up, you know, the new miniseries picked up several years later. And so I basically filled in the gap between her jumping off the Ferris wheel in front of the press and where the miniseries started. That was my task with that novella. And I had a lot of fun with that, actually. I got to you know, do some bridging work between the two series, you know, following up on some things from the original series and setting up things for the miniseries, you know, sort of retroactively, and also getting to use some characters who weren't available to be used in the miniseries, like Siler and Peter Petrelli.
Yeah.
So, and Claire, not Claire.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have to work closely with the writing team and things like that for the TV show?
Closely. Actually, that was... The Heroes experience was one of the most interesting and one of the best tie-in experiences I've ever had, because I was working directly with James Middleton, who was the showrunner, basically. Mm. You know, he was Tim Kring's second in command, more or less, and the person who was actually in charge of the day-to-day of the show. And we all of us were getting regular script updates. so I knew everything that was going to happen, and I actually had to make adjustments to my novella as other things, you know, were developed and changed and such, which was great. But they were really invested in making these novellas tie in as closely as possible with the show, and actually being a part of the greater texture, which is rare. It was, like I said, it was great. It was a really wonderful experience working with them. And it is really, really rare to work with the showrunner. The only other time it's happened on a show that was ongoing while I was working on it. There've been, once I've done tie-ins for stuff after they've gone off the air, like the Farscape comics. In that case, you know, it's a different situation because you're not tying into something ongoing. Hmm. But usually, if you're writing a tie-in to, especially an existing TV show, you're not dealing with the people running the show because they're too busy running the show.
Yeah,
they don't have time for that. But in this case, you know, because the Heroes creators were invested in making all the tie-in merchandise be part of the bigger tapestry. The only other time that's happened was with Leverage. John Rogers, at the very least, approved my outline for the Leverage novel. I don't know if he was the one who approved the final manuscript or not. But John Rogers also comes out of the comics world and is more familiar with the publishing end of things and the tie-in end of things and work for higher stuff. So I think he was more aware of the process and more interested in making sure the novels worked.
Well, it must be great as a writer to have that level of interest from showrunners to say, look, you know, we've got our show, but we want to create something, you know, in terms of a novel or a novella or anything that actually does link to and does tie in and is canon and everything. It must be really nice to feel that you're part of that tapestry and you're part of that continuing story.
The people who are making TV shows now are ones who grew up reading, you know, Star Trek novels and Star Wars novels and stuff. So they're, you know, and comic books and things. So I think that's part of it. It's just that you've got now a generation of producers and scriptwriters and filmmakers and directors and such who have all grew up with an awareness of that, maybe even read them, you know, and such, and so are more interested in making it be part of it. So.
Yeah.
It doesn't always work that way, but you know, it's still nice to do. You know, and sometimes, you know, even if, like, I did a Sleepy Hollow novel a couple of years ago that I didn't get, you know, I wasn't working directly with, you know, Len Wiseman and Phyllis Scobie or anything like that, but I did get a couple of springboards, just, you know, one sentence notions of possible stories to use, which was useful in that it meant I wouldn't be stepping on anybody's toes in terms, like it was like what I wound up doing was a follow up to the second episode of the show. And that was one of the things they suggested, because that told me that they weren't really going to do anything with that particular character, so that I was free to do what I wanted with her. So that worked out nicely.
That's great. Even that level of communication is really good, definitely.
Yeah.
Let's hope that Brian Fuller for the new Star Trek series does that. Wouldn't that be great?
We'll see. but other stuff I've got, I mentioned the Marvel's Tales of Asgard trilogy. The Thor book is actually out as an ebook, and the print book is supposed to be released in March.
Okay.
The second, it's called Dueling with Giants. A Sith book called Even Dragons Have Their Endings will be out in May. And I'm trying desperately to finish my Warriors 3 novel, which is called Godhood's End, which hopefully will be out in July.
Terrific.
I've got the Heroes Reborn novella that you mentioned. I've got another Jonathan Mayberry edited anthology published by IDW called V-Wars Night Terrors, which is the third anthology in Jonathan's shared world vampire series, V-Wars. Mm. I've got a story in that called Streets of Fire. I've got a story, also another Jonathan project. He and I like to work together. Jonathan is co-editing with George Romero an anthology called Knights of the Living Dead, which are stories that take place around the movie. The
original. That's awesome. That is awesome.
Yeah. I'm doing a story for that. And I'm doing Diversion is putting out an anthology called Alternate Sherlocks, which is being edited by Michael Ventrella, which is basically a whole bunch of Sherlock Holmes stories that take place anywhere but Victorian London.
Oh wow! That's brilliant. I can't wait for that.
That hopefully will be out later this year or early next year, depending. And then I've got some original fantasy coming. I'm doing an urban fantasy series with Wordfire Press. Which is The Adventures of Brom Gold, which is about a nice Jewish boy from the Bronx who hunts monsters.
Sounds great.
First book is called A Furnace Sealed, and that'll be out hopefully this fall. And I'm also working on some new novellas in my Super City Police Department series, which is about cops in a city filled with superheroes. These are going to be novellas that are going to be released serially, and we're still developing and working on how that's going to happen. But that ought to be really cool when that happens.
Yeah. So.
Oh, also, I'm doing, there's a site, popular culture site run by Tor Books called Tor.com. I've been doing rewatches of classic TV shows for them, and I'm currently doing rewatches of two shows celebrating their 50th anniversary this year, the original Star Trek,
yeah,
and also the Adam West Batman.
Oh, of course, yeah, Batman as well, yeah. Oh, that must be fun, looking at those.
Star Trek on Tuesdays, Batman on Fridays, watching an episode and commenting on it and such. So,
oh, that's great. Definitely check that out.
They did an X-Files rewatch about 2-3 years ago.
Yeah. Was that for the 20th anniversary?
Thereabouts, yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Alex Monica did that for them.
Oh, cool,
You can find the archives on that on Tor.com as well.
Well, yeah, if you are listening to the X-Cast guys and you haven't found those, go and have a look for them, definitely. That all sounds brilliant, Keith. It sounds like you've got some wonderful, varied, exciting projects coming up. So, yeah, it's going to be great to see all those come to fruition. Brilliant. I've got one final question, which is one I always ask on the podcast, and it's simply a question called Do You Believe In? And in every episode, we normally ask the guest what if they believe in the specific paranormality of the episode in question. But in this case, I'm just going to ask you, Keith, do you believe in the paranormal?
Yes, given how much I use it in fiction, yeah. In fact, the answer is no. I'm very much a rationalist. I only believe in things that I have evidence of.
Mm.
Having said that, it's still something that fascinates me as a writer. The fact that I don't believe in it doesn't mean I'm not interested in it. And that I'm not interested in the phenomenon and in where these stories come from.
Mm.
And what effect those stories have on who we are as people. And what effect who we are as people have on those stories as well. There's you know, what makes a culture what it is the stories it tells, and that's what these basically are. A lot of the paranormal beliefs that people have are based in essence trying to tell the story of how the world works.
Mm.
You know, a lot of myths come from people trying to explain where things came from or why things are done. The religious stories in most mythologies from pretty much all of them are ways to try to explain how the world works. So yeah. That interests me, but it's not. But again, I'm very much a rationalist as far as that goes.
You're Scully, not Mulder.
Pretty much, yeah. Except I'm not Catholic. But
okay, well thanks for that. Yeah, it's interesting how many people actually who come on the X-Cast when asked that question, the general question, say they are a skeptic or they are more, you know, rational. And it's always interesting how people love writing about this, but always think of it in a very rational way. So yeah, you're not on your own there. Huge thanks, Keith, for giving up your time, your very precious time and your very busy time to come onto the X-Cast and talk about your X-Files piece and your career in general. It's been a real thrill to speak to you.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. So where are we best to find you online in terms of where you are? Are you on Twitter? Are you on – you have a dedicated website, I assume, and everything like that?
I have a website that is finally being upgraded, although it hasn't happened yet. My website is decandido.net. It's my last name, .net. And it's right now it's a very poorly designed link dump that looks like it was designed by somebody who learned HTML in 1996, which is because it was designed by somebody who learned HTML in 1996, to wit me. But I am in the process of having it upgraded. The upgrade is not done yet. However, from there, from decandido.net, it links you to my blog, my Facebook page, my Twitter feed, the rewatches I'm doing for Tor.com, and it's got ordering information for my most recent fiction as well, including Trust No One and the Heroes Reborn novella and my other recent stuff, my original fiction, and all that good stuff. So
excellent. Thank you. Yeah, do check out Keith's website. It's great. It's got lots of great links to everything he's done. And also, please, you know, if you haven't already, and I'm sure most of you will have done or you will do, but please do go and seek out the X-Files Trust No One anthology for Keith's story and a bunch of other really great stories by some really talented other authors as well. You can get that now on Amazon.com or Amazon.co.uk, depending on where you're listening from, at a really good price. So yeah, please do go out and support that, because it's tremendous. It's great, great fun. We will be back for a continued look at the X-Files, whether it's continued look at Season 10 or our traditional episodes very soon. You can, of course, find us on Twitter at @X_cast and on Facebook at @TheXcast. And we're also at our home at Black Hole Media, which is our overall podcast network we're part of. That's, you can find us at www.blackholepodcast.com. And please do come over there and check us out. And yeah, you can also find us on iTunes. So please do subscribe at the XCast and give us a like. And if you can, leave us a little review, because that'll help us become even more well-known in X-Files fandom. So yeah, it leaves me to just thank you again, Keith, for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And we'll see you again soon, guys. And remember, trust no one.